John was going to be introducing me, I got kind of nervous because John and I have worked on several projects here in the last 5 or 6 years, and we got to talking out in the break room, and he says, "You know, Alan, I've seen you at your worst," and I got to thinking there was the night in Vegas that might have qualified a little bit, John, and then there was a night in Saratoga, Wyoming, where my flight was late and I didn't get to the hotel in Saratoga till 4 a.m. and we were supposed to start preg checking cows at 6 a.m. so I slept in my car and I had pink eye, so John knocked on my window the next morning and thought I was dead. But then he said, "You know, Alan, I've seen you at your best too, and really there's not much difference." So I don't know if that was a good comment or a bad comment, so I'll just leave it at that. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks, George and the committee for having me. I'm going to try to talk a little bit today about nutrition. It's a little bit scary, a reproductive physiologist talking about nutrition, but I'm going to try to focus on specific aspects of nutrition and how it mediates reproductive function. And I'm going to extend on some of the work that George has talked about and bring in some other work on how, as we're trying to get this cow pregnant or heifer pregnant through estrus synchronization and AI, we really need to be cognizant on the nutritional aspects that this animal is receiving, because it can have direct effects on both the oocyte, the follicle, the corpus luteum, and then the developing embryo. So you've been bombarded here the last day and a half with the ovary and the estrous cycle and how we need to control reproductive hormones, to control the estrous cycle, induce the ovulation of a competent oocyte, and ensure we have good sperm to fertilize this oocyte and it's put in the proper spot during artificial insemination. Then we get embryonic development and fertilization and embryonic development, and then we travel to the uterus, and it's really interesting the dynamic of the oviduct in the uterus and how it supports this embryonic development. Then, of course, this embryo develops into an elongated conceptus through the production of interferon tau, signals pregnancy, and hopefully this pregnancy is maintained through gestation, and we get a live, healthy calf. And of course, with Dr. Funston's talk, how all this nutritional interaction during this period might actually affect how this calf performs over its lifetime. So I'm going to try to overlay some of how nutrition can affect these processes, specifically focusing here on the oocyte and the early embryo. And I apologize, I don't know if I can reach that. There we go, right there, the oocyte and the early embryo. So, and what nutritional metabolites specifically can be affecting these? We've known for years, and this was a study, a review article by Ron Randall at Texas A&M, over just general nutrition, protein deficit or energy deficit, and its effect on pregnancy success. Because ultimately that's what we're interested, right? Do my cows get pregnant? And this is just, we've known for years that inadequate protein or inadequate energy, cows don't get pregnant. And I'm not going to review this literature, and we've also known for years, and Scott Lake this morning talked about it, that cows that are not in the right body condition score are anestrous longer. And of course, an anestrous cow doesn't show heat. A cow that doesn't show heat doesn't get pregnant. And we have this issue of anestrous. But even once a cow leaves that anestrous state and becomes cycling, nutrition can impart many differential effects on reproductive processes. This is just an outline, a review article by Diskin, of all the things that nutrition can affect, and specific nutritional metabolites and hormones. We're going to talk about three, or four specifically, leptin, glucose, insulin-like growth factor 1, and insulin. So, in the cyclic animal versus the anestrous animal, there's a little bit of differences. Scott Lake this morning talked about if we have cows that are thin at calving, that postpartum anestrous interval extends, correct? She doesn't start cycling in time, she doesn't get pregnant in time, she gets cold. During this anestrous period, a lot of the mediation, nutritional mediation of reproduction is through the gonadotropins. Decreased nutrition, decreased LH synthesis and secretion. This reduction in LH extends this postpartum interval. What we see in most cyclic animals, or animals that are having estrous cycles, is that until we suppress nutrition enough that this animal goes anestrous, we don't see a lot of response to LH on nutritional suppression. Rather, we see a lot of differences in these other nutritional metabolites that are dictating reproductive function. So that's what I wanted to focus on today, is our animal that is having estrous cycles and she is nutritionally stressed, what hormones are we mediating that are going to affect whether or not she ovulates a healthy follicle, that oocyte within that follicle is competent, can be fertilized, and whether or not it can develop into an embryo and eventually a pregnancy. So our first one, excuse me, I'm fighting a little bit of a cold, is insulin. And insulin is a hormone produced by the pancreas. You know, when we eat, so I'm the speaker right before lunch, so I know everybody's just thinking about what we're having for lunch and not listening to me. But after we eat lunch, we're going to get a nutrient intake, a lot of glucose. We're going to release insulin. Insulin's going to allow those cells to bring that glucose into the cell and be utilized. Same thing works in the cow. So insulin has some distinct effects in the cow, specifically at the ovary. Insulin is known to increase estrogen production by this dominant follicle. So an animal that is nutritionally suppressed and is not producing enough insulin due to this nutritional suppression, estradiol concentrations are going to suffer. Well, I spent my whole PhD studying how important estradiol is to the maintenance of pregnancy. Short end of the story, low estradiol prior to ovulation during the development of that follicle, we don't get a proper uterine function and also oocyte function, and we don't get pregnancy. So if we inhibit estradiol, pregnancy is reduced. We see in animals that have adequate insulin, it helps drive increased follicular growth. Therefore, in nutritionally stressed animals, less insulin, less growth of the dominant follicle. Dr. Perry spent a lot of his PhD work with Mike Smith in here looking at how dominant follicle size impacts fertility. Animals that ovulate smaller dominant follicles in our ester synchronization programs, guess what? They have reduced fertility. Now, that's interacting with estrogen, of course, but if we have a nutritionally suppressed animal that has lower insulin levels, reduce estradiol, reduce dominant follicle growth. Superstimulated animals, we see a decrease in ovulation rate. And once that animal ovulates and fertilization occurs, if there's not adequate insulin in circulation due to nutritional stress, the blastocyst development, or the development of this embryo, is retarded, and those embryos are less likely to make it through maternal recognition of pregnancy. I forgot my animation. I apologize. However, we have to be careful, because as we'll talk about later, too much of a good thing is often a bad thing, right? And we can all think of examples of this, except for maybe love and money. But if we overfeed an animal, and I grew up in Missouri, and we had tendency to have some cheap corn growing up and ample pastures, and sometimes we had cows too fat. Especially those that were in the show circuit and had that really large heifer that was a high-dollar, valuable animal that was carrying too much body fat. And I get a call every year, I've got a valuable heifer, she's been on the show circuit, and I can't get her pregnant. Well, too much of a good thing is a bad thing. So she's probably too heavy. The same thing happens in our fat animals. We get hyperinsulinemia. She's producing too much insulin. And too much insulin does the exact same thing as not enough insulin. We see a decrease in oocyte quality that results in decreased fertilization or cleavage rates of that oocyte, and we have reduced blastocyst development. This study was, I don't remember where it was conducted, but they looked at blastocyst development. So these were cows on two different nutritional planes, either starting out at a low body condition score or a moderate body condition score, being fed to maintenance or being fed two times to maintenance. Then they yanked these oocytes out off the ovary and took them to the in vitro fertilization lab, fertilized them, and see how they developed. You can see that if they were on, focus on the top here, they are in a low body condition score increasing, they had better blastocyst development. If they are on a moderate body condition score and staying there, good blastocyst development. But if they were thin and staying thin, bad blastocyst development. Or if they were fat and getting fatter, poor blastocyst development. So we have to manage this. Again, too much is not a good thing in this case. IGF-1, or insulin-like growth factor 1. This hormone is in response to growth hormone secretion from the anterior pituitary. causes IGF-1 release. This is a protein that signals cell proliferation. And one of the things we have to recognize with IGF-1 is it's escorted through the blood and through circulation by binding proteins. So these binding proteins help extend the half-life, and they can interact. Some binding proteins are good, help with the IGF-1 signal, and some impede it. But there are 6 of them right now. We won't go into that in too much detail. But what we can see is a lot of the similar things happen when we have nutritional stress. IGF-1 goes down. The animal's not receiving the nutrients that she needs. That one of the signals is a reduction in IGF-1. Again, less IGF-1, less follicular growth. What we see is oocytes are pretty responsive to IGF-1, and if they don't have adequate IGF-1 concentrations, they actually begin to die. Apoptosis, or cell death. Lastly, that embryo is sensitive to IGF-1 and IGF-2, another isoform of IGF, and that inadequate IGF-1 and IGF-2 concentrations cause a decrease in embryo development and reduction in blastocyst rates. And I know there are several people in the audience that are veterinarians that do a lot of super stimulation and embryo transfer, so this is some pretty important stuff to consider, and we'll talk about some more of this data as we go along. Glucose. Glucose is another important nutritional metabolite, and it's what the body uses as energy. Interestingly, in ruminants, glucose is pretty tightly regulated, unlike monogastrics. But in the follicle, glucose is sequestered, because glucose is one of the primary energy substrates for that developing oocyte. We reduce glucose by diet nutritional stress. We are able to reduce the competence of this oocyte. So less glucose due to less dietary energy. If our cows are losing weight, if our cows are thin, we affect this oocyte. Also, within the uterus, glucose is one of the main energy substrates for the developing conceptus. So that uterus secretes a lot of glucose into the uterine lumen, and we'll talk a little bit more about the uterus as we go. If we have inadequate glucose concentrations, it can impede some of this embryo elongation. There's some new work coming out of Texas A&M with the, it's actually in sheep mostly, but looking at some of the cell signaling pathways that initiate embryo elongation. So from the blastocyst stage to this stage for maternal recognition of pregnancy. And glucose and some other nutrients secreted by the uterus are really critical to initiating this process. And if it's not initiated, that embryo doesn't grow. The embryo doesn't grow, guess what? It doesn't send that signal of maternal recognition of pregnancy. Cows don't realize they're pregnant, like George said, and then they come back into heat and we have a lot of open cows. Lastly is leptin, and leptin's been pretty popular here for, what, last 10 years, Bob? Probably longer than that, it'll be 15. So leptin is a little bit of a unique marker. It's made by adipose cells. And so if you have a lot of fat, like me, I should have high circulating concentrations of leptin because it's telling me that I'm fat enough and I don't need to eat. Fortunately for me, my own brain can override that, and I really enjoy eating, so I eat anyway. But the idea of leptin is, as adipose cells increase, leptin increases. And leptin sends a signal to stop appetite, to kind of control body weight. Leptin also is becoming more and more important in reproductive function. If we have animals that are losing weight, they're losing body fat, leptin goes down. This decrease in leptin coming from the fat cells causes a decrease in insulin. We've already talked about the bad things that happen there. A decrease in IGF-1, and some new studies would show that actually leptin can have a direct effect on LH pulsatility. LH is one of our basic our reproductive hormones. We start messing with LH, we have poor reproductive function. So we have to, and this is another mechanism that nutritionally stressed animals have reduced fertility. But we also have too much leptin. So we get too much leptin and get our fat cow syndrome. We see that over leptin also inhibits actions of insulin on steroid production. We get decreased estradiol production by the granulosas and androstenedione production by the thecal cells. Fat cows, too much insulin, too much leptin, they have a reduction in follicle growth, oocyte competence. So we have a lot of management to do there. This is some new data looking at the nutritional stressors and how that affects follicular growth. And I threw this up here just to provide some data to support what I was talking about. And in this study, they had heifers that were either fed a control or 1.2 times maintenance, or they were restricted at 0.4 times maintenance. And that's a pretty heavy restriction. But like George said earlier, this is the same group that had that Mackey 1999 paper that George referenced. That would be about a 3.5-4 pound a day loss. So we have seen that. George has seen that in some of his heifer data. So this nutritional stress can occur in our beef cows. So what they saw is that this in these animals that were restricted, they did see a reduction in estradiol. They didn't see a difference in follicle diameter in this study, But one of the key indicators of oocyte competence and the health of that potential oocyte is your estradiol to progesterone ratio. A healthy oocyte is going to have a high ratio, more estradiol than progesterone. However, or follicle, I should say. A unhealthy follicle is going to have a lower ratio, more progesterone than estradiol. And you can see that in these nutrient-restricted animals, they had follicles that had a skewed estrogen to progesterone ratio, indicating that, in fact, that oocyte may be compromised. Additionally, they saw a decrease in IGF-1. That's also probably driving some of these factors and cholesterol. And one of the pathways that they proposed that all this is happening, and I'm not going to go into great detail, but nutrient restriction prevents some steroids synthesis within cells, the theca cells within the follicle. It's preventing cholesterol production, and cholesterol is our backbone for all of our steroid hormones, and it's also preventing the gene responsible for transporting of this cholesterol into the cell so estradiol can be made. And so all that is seen in animals that are nutritionally stressed. So this nutritional stress can have some dramatic effects on the developing follicle and on the oocyte. And it feels like I'm rushing a little bit, but I want to get everybody ready for lunch because I'm hungry too. We also have to consider how nutrition might impact embryonic losses in cattle. And our beef cows, and I should have just gotten rid of the dairy because nobody wants to talk about dairy here, but in our beef animals, fertilization rates are quite high, 85 to 90%. So most of the oocytes get fertilized if timing of insemination is correct and you're using good semen and yada, yada, yada. However, by the time we come out and preg check, only about 60% of those animals are still pregnant. So we have quite a bit of embryonic mortality. And what's driving this embryonic mortality? Well, of course, one thing is ovulation of a competent oocyte. And we already talked about how nutrition can mediate the follicle, and the follicle is that structure that contains the oocyte, and also the oocyte competence itself. So if we have nutritional stress and this oocyte is challenged, it might not be as viable. When it's fertilized and starts developing in an embryo, its potential to develop into a healthy embryo might be influenced. In addition, we have all these uterine functions, and the cattle are a unique species that once ovulation occurs and the oocyte is fertilized, this embryo spends a prolonged period within that uterus without a definitive attachment. And so it's not just floating in there willy-nilly, but it hasn't developed any placentation yet. And so it's really dependent upon support of this uterus and all of its secretions that keep it alive and growing. And what we're learning more and more is that nutrition may be influencing these uterine secretions, the compositions not only in the uterus but the oviduct, and ultimately affecting how this conceptus or embryo grows and develops. So how does nutrition mediate all these factors? Well, we can have direct effects. Of course, we can feed things that that can affect the uterine function and actually have a direct toxicity effect on the developing embryo and conceptus. Cottonseed, I don't think anybody here probably feeds cottonseed. There are some compounds in cottonseed that can directly do this. Fescue toxicity is having more of an issue on the oocyte, but can still do some of these damages. We can have indirect actions by directly impacting conceptus growth. So if our nutrition is impeding the uterus from functioning properly, what happens is it's not giving out the growth factors required, and that conceptus eventually dies. Or nutrition can impede other endocrine functions. We have an unhealthy follicle due to undernutrition. A lot of times once that follicle ovulates and develops into a CL, that CL is not as active, doesn't produce as much progesterone. Progesterone is required for pregnancy maintenance. Less progesterone, usually less chance of pregnancy establishment. So this is just highlighting some of the effects. This histotroph produced by the uterus is full of a lot of enzymes, cytokines, growth factors, nutrients, IGF-1, IGF-2, amino acids. Glucose, fructose, amino acids are the major components that are directly relaying growth factors to this developing conceptus. All of these may be influenced by our nutritional inputs to our cows. We reduce nutritionally stress these animals. We are affecting glucose, fructose, and these amino acids in the uterine lumen, thus eventually impacting the development of this conceptus. So this is just kind of an overview slide of where we're at now. Nutrition mediation of reproductive function occurs during the entire development of the oocyte, early embryo, and as this embryo develops within the uterus. So anytime we nutritionally stress these animals, we run the risk of causing a reduction in fertility due to either oocyte competence, early embryonic death, or impeding the development of this conceptus, causing an inability to secrete interferon tau or go through maternal recognition of pregnancy. So let's get into some more practical research now and some practical management is how do we balance this? Undernutrition, overnutrition, we have to have an adequate balance of these animals so that they maintain a proper body condition score during the productive lifespan. And during various stages of the production cycle, we know that's difficult. Dr. Lake already talked about lactation and the increased energy demands during lactation. The likelihood of losing body condition score during that period. So what we've been trying to determine in some of our research is how does postpartum nutrition affect either the oocyte, embryonic development, and or uterine function? And does declining nutrition have a greater impact on the oocyte or the uterus? So we've been playing around with an animal model where we calve all of our cows out at a body condition score 5. And so that's about where we want in a target body condition score. And then during the postpartum period, we manipulate body condition score. We'll take a group of these and we'll feed them a little extra and get them to a 6. We'll take a group of these and feed them a little less and bring them down to a 4 over about an 80-day period. So up to the breeding season. So in this study, we did this and we developed super-stimulated embryo donors. So once they reached their target 6 and 4, super-stimulated 10 cows per treatment, collected embryos out of them on day 7. Then we froze those embryos, and then once we got the rest of our cow herd to where we needed them to be, we transferred. So we would take an embryo from a body condition score 6 and transfer her into a recipient of a body condition score 6. So that's our positive control. We'd take an embryo from a body condition score 6 and transfer it into a uterus of a body condition score 4 cow. So a good embryo going into a bad uterus in theory. Test uterine effects. A body condition score 4 embryo into a body condition score 6. So in theory, a potentially bad oocyte, bad embryo going into a good uterus, and then the negative control of a 4 going into a 4. So what we saw, and this has been shown before, so it's not like it's rocket science here, but in our animals that were in a body condition score 4 when we did the super stimulation and embryo collection, we saw a tendency for a reduction in embryo stage. So those embryos weren't quite as developed as they were in the cows out of the body condition score 6. Grade did not differ, but when you look at proportion of freezable embryos, so this is just grade 1 or grade 2, there was another tendency for a difference between the body condition score 4 and the body condition score 6. The number of embryos that were freezable and the percent freezable were reduced in those animals that were of inadequate body condition. So this decrease in nutrition was driving a reduction in embryo development and decreased the number of grade 1 and grade 2 embryos that we were able to flush out. However, be cautious, because with that data you might say, well, I want to get everybody to a 6 or above to maximize my embryo recovery, right? Because that's what we're, if we're in the ET business, the more embryos we get, the more embryos we transfer, the more potential pregnancies we get, and the more dollars we can make. Is that right, Dr. Hasler? Did I summarize that up pretty good? Okay. So, too much of a good thing is a bad thing, remember. And this is a study summarized by Jose Santos looking at adequate versus excess nutrition. And like we said earlier, in animals that got excess nutrition, they saw just the same things as animals that had deficient nutrition. Decreased viable embryos that flush. So, much like beer in a little bit is good, right? I think so. But beer in excess is bad. And I don't know how much partying went on last night, but I hope nobody got to this stage here. So remember, everything's in moderation. So we want to make sure animals are in an adequate body condition score, but we don't want to go to the extremes. Obesity is an interesting thing. Even in all mammalian species, obesity reduces fertility. Same thing happens in cows. You get them too fat, you have reduced fertility. So usually at events like this, you don't show data that don't support your hypothesis, but I'm not that smart, so I'm going to go ahead and show you this because I think we need to discuss it. So we took those embryos then, that we collected from the fours and sixes, and we transferred them to our four and six recipients, expecting that, oh, we're going to have great fertility in the sixes and we're going to have horrible fertility in the fours. And if we look at endocrine responses, that would support our hypothesis. And these recipient cows that were in body condition score 4, follicle diameter was reduced, the CL diameter was reduced, they produced less progesterone during the ester cycle. So when we put the embryos in, they had reduced progesterone. 7 days after we put the embryos in, they had less progesterone as well. But when we got to pregnancy rates, we saw no difference. Limited numbers, of course, when we saw a little bit numerical, 6% difference in those recipients with the body condition score 4. So we're still trying to determine exactly why we didn't see a difference. We were pretty confident that nutrition affects reproduction, or I just wasted the entire 20 minutes of your life giving the first part of my talk. So we're repeating some of this to try to figure out what happened. So nutrition impacted the number of transferal embryos. In the recipients, follicle size was impacted, CL diameter and progesterone was impacted, but we did not see effect on pregnancy status. We don't know if there was an acclimation to this negative energy. These cows were maintained at a 4 for about 30 days. Maybe that had an effect. And we only transferred grade 1 and grade 2 embryos. So if it is an oocyte embryo effect, we might have masked that because we cherry-picked which embryos we transferred. Now, give me 5 more minutes and I'll finish up so we can get to lunch. If we look at post-AI impacts on pregnancy, and Dr. Perry already hit on this quite a bit, we've known for years that we've had effective ester synchronization protocols. We've talked about that yesterday. Yet, in beef heifers especially, we see a lot of variability. Talking to the guys in the audience and gals, you know, we breed a group of heifers, and same protocol, same semen, will be at 60% and will be at 40%, and we have a lot of variability. So we got to thinking, what other managerial factors are impacting AI pregnancy rates, and basically, what are we screwing up? And so this led us down to this whole heifer development and how nutrition post-insemination affects the development of this embryo. And since George covered all this, I'm going to breeze through it quite a bit, but this is Dr. Perry's work, and we often forget that the feedlot is not the pasture. So that when we move these heifers from the feedlot into the pasture, George has already demonstrated, we have this loss in body weight. And, of course, accompanying this loss in body weight, you can expect dynamic changes in our nutritional metabolites that we already discussed. So another study that George didn't get to was a study conducted by actually Scott Lake's group and a group out of Purdue that they specifically fed heifers after insemination to either gain, maintain, or lose weight. So about 120% maintenance, 100% maintenance, or 80% maintenance. This is the body weight change they saw. So this diet change occurred on the day of AI and lasted 21 days post-AI. Again, hit their targets pretty close. Those that were supposed to gain, gained. Those that were supposed to maintain, maintained. And those that were supposed to lose weight, lost weight. If you look at first AI conception rates, it followed a similar pattern that Dr. Perry was talking about. By maintaining or decreasing nutrition, overall AI pregnancy rates were about 10% lower overall, 10 to 20% lower overall. Significant difference there. This is a wrong slide. And also seasoned pregnancy rates also tended to be affected. So we're seeing that this nutrition post-AI in a very short period is reducing pregnancy success. So we repeated this study because we were pretty excited about it. And again, this is an example of you're not supposed to show data unless it's positive data. And this is the first year that I showed in previous slides. We repeated it this year, and this is what we got. Not a whole lot of difference there. It bounced around quite a bit on us. And we're trying to figure out why that is. But when you still combine years, we still see this tendency that if they're losing or only maintaining weight after AI, we're seeing a decrease in pregnancy response. George hit on this study, so in essence of time, I'm not going to talk about it in too much. But we wanted to see what was directly happening to this embryo following AI when this nutritional stress was occurring. So we grew heifers out 120% maintenance to the time of AI. Then they either got 120% maintenance for the next 6 days or 80% maintenance for the next 6 days. I did a similar thing in South Dakota. And we took these embryos out on day 6 and we stained them for accessory sperm, dead cells, and total cells within the embryo. And what we saw was, in fact, that if you reduce nutrition for as little as 6 days following insemination, we saw a reduction in embryo stage, so the embryos in the loose treatment were not as advanced. Embryo quality was reduced. We had fewer total cells and fewer percent cells live. So we were about one cell cycle behind in these. They were about one cell cycle behind just by a 6 day difference in nutrition. So what we think is happening, we get this switch from a feedlot diet to a grass diet. It's having a metabolic train wreck. And this is resulting in alterations in oviductal secretion supporting that early embryonic development. Once that embryo enters uterus, the secretions are also altered either in amount or in what substrates are there, ultimately resulting in a smaller embryo during maternal recognition of pregnancy and pregnancy failure. So with that, I'm going to end today. I appreciate your time. Nutrition's pretty important, and I hope I did an adequate job of trying to get through that in a decent amount of time and describing how nutrition is affecting the oocyte and embryo. So with that, thank you.